Good afternoon. It is the 12th of July, 2003. This is the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator. I like antiwar.com because the regular columnists almost always agree with me, only they're a lot smarter than me and they write a hell of a lot better. One of their newest regular columnists and sharpest wits is Matthew Barganier. He writes Collateral Damage. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Philip.
How you doing?
I'm just fine. Just enjoying a hot afternoon in Baton Rouge.
All right. I got up this morning and I looked at antiwar.com headlines and I actually saw some good ones.
Yeah, I was looking at some of those too. I'd be interested to see which ones you thought were good.
The ones about that Bush's approval ratings slipping.
Right. Those are normally the ones that I think are good. Lately, especially about Tony Blair's troubles in Great Britain, those are the ones that warm my heart.
Why don't you tell us what you know about that? What's old phony Tony facing this week?
Well, he seems to have gotten himself embroiled in this real mess with the BBC, which is quite interesting because, you know, the BBC is state-controlled broadcasting. But it seems that the BBC is more defiant and more of a thorn in the side of the state than our capitalist press here in the United States is. You know, we have this suck-up press from Fox to CNN to the New York Times here that just pretty much eats up whatever the press or whatever the press secretary puts out for them to regurgitate. And over there, the BBC in particular has been very critical of Blair's handling of the war, and there are lots of questions about the information that they passed off to justify Britain's participation in the Iraq War. So,
was there a particular charge that the BBC made that brought up all this particular controversy?
Well, a lot of it has to do with this uranium shipment that supposedly took place from Niger to Iraq. And this has turned out to be, in the estimation of impartial experts from the International Atomic Energy Agency and others, to just be a complete fraud. You know, this was just a forgery. And the Blair administration which is getting smaller all the time as certain of his cabinet ministers drop out or distance themselves from him. But Blair himself, I should say, is still sticking by this. And he seems to be threatening the BBC with some sort of government oversight or some sort of investigation, some sort of punishment if they keep reporting this story, which has been verified, like I said, by a third-party, disinterested sources, that this uranium shipment was just complete bull.
How do you explain that the BBC, that at least is possibly under the state control of the Prime Minister's office over there, how do you make out that they're telling the truth or trying their best, and our media that is free market, like you said, and wants the best ratings possible, they won't touch this kind of stuff?
I really don't know, and this is something that I have wrestled with, because it does seem to me that it should be the exact opposite. Of course, the press here, there is a difference between saying that it's capitalist and that it's free market. In other words, there are certainly a hell of a lot of private profits that are accrued to Fox and CNN, and the few companies that own almost all of the well-respected press. But just because they're private profits doesn't mean that they're untainted by state influence. Of course, they get to do the things that they do, especially in television and in radio, because they're granted state monopolies, you know, through licensing and such. And so they have to maintain a certain friendly posture towards the state.
So they're not much more independent from the state, or maybe even less independent from the state than in Great Britain.
Right. Well, the BBC, you know, just since it's a fact of life that it's operated by the government, I guess they sort of think, you know, what do they have to lose, right? You know, they can get away with things to a certain point, then they might as well push it to that point. Whereas here, and also, you know, they don't have to play as much for public popularity, which Fox obviously does, and CNN and MSNBC with all the flags waving on their little graphics that they show during their really sycophantic interviews with these people like, you know, Clifford May is a particular annoyance to me from this Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. These guys who run all of these one-person foundations and think tanks, so that there's something to put under their name when they appear on Fox. And of course, they're allegedly private, but they're not really. These guys are all ex-government. Are some of them, like Richard Perle, have one foot in both the think tanks and in government still. So, when those are the sorts of people who are relied upon as experts by the free press in this country, it's no wonder that you get just more and more government propaganda.
Yeah, I noticed very few links on antiwar.com lead to Fox News stories.
I actually try to throw in a couple on mine. You know, if I can find something on Fox, I throw in a lot of links to things that are just absolutely ridiculous. And so Fox is a rich source of that for me. But, yeah, there aren't a lot of links to that. In fact, a lot of the links on antiwar.com, I would venture to say nearly half, come from overseas sources, particularly in Australia and Great Britain, and English web versions of Russian newspapers and German newspapers and so forth.
And that's because the good information is in the Russian papers?
Ouch. It's not so much that it's not so much that you can act as if, oh, well, the American press is so biased and it's so unbiased everywhere else. It's just more that, you know, when Russian papers talk about the situation in Chechnya, for instance, they're going to be just as biased as Fox is when it talks about American interest or American activities in Iraq or Afghanistan, right? But when a Russian newspaper like Pravda talks about the American situation, they don't really have a particular interest at stake. So they don't have to play the story one way or the other. It's not exactly that you're getting the unfiltered God's truth or anything. It's just that they don't have some sort of personal stake in manipulating the facts. Right?
Sure.
They rely for their information, you know, it's partly a sourcing problem, that the information that they rely on is in many cases skewered right from the source. It's like CENTCOM. It's U.S. military reports coming out of Baghdad.
Or just an anonymous administration official said.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of it's problematic right from the very source, but, you know, when you're comparing fake apples versus fake oranges, there still might be some sort of value in getting a disinterested opinion on the difference between the two.
Sure. Hey, let me ask you, back to the Niger uranium question and the State of the Union speech and the false assertions made by our president. All this week, I guess especially in the last couple of days as the heat's been turned up, the administration, I guess especially yesterday, the president and his national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and others put the blame solely on the shoulders of the CIA and said that the CIA failed to warn them that that particular statement in the State of the Union wasn't true, and that it's all their fault.
Yeah, that's one of the wonderful things about the so-called separation of powers in this country. There really isn't any separation of powers. As Bush has shown, he can declare war unilaterally. He can do all of these things that really Congress is supposed to do. And, of course, the federal courts do all sorts of things that Congress and the state legislatures are supposed to do. But when it comes time to hand out blame, you have this enormous bureaucracy where you can say, oh, I got bad information from them. It's their fault. And so somehow the CIA, which is under the purview of the president, it's right there in the executive branch, somehow when the CIA tells a fib, and by the way, there's a good deal of speculation based on, again, anonymous sources, that Cheney was going into the CIA and putting unprecedented pressure on them to turn out intelligence that suited the administration's agenda. But, you know, it works out fine for them that they can just say, well, it's the CIA's fault. And no one will think, well, who's in charge of the CIA? When you get right down to it, it's, of course, the president.
Well, and what's funny to me is that the Democrats who are campaigning for president, they're coming out and being very critical of the CIA as well. They're not blaming... Joe Lieberman came out and also blamed George Tenet and anybody below him, but definitely nobody above.
Yeah, well, Lieberman you have to watch out for, because Lieberman could possibly, out of the whole field of Democratic candidates, and I'll go ahead and include Hillary in this, since she's a shadow candidate for 2004. Lieberman and Hillary are the two who could possibly be even more belligerent than Bush. But a lot of this plays with Democratic Party circles because there's sort of this automatic hatred of the CIA. And I'm certainly not saying that that's unfounded. But it's easy to for a politician to manipulate the feelings of liberals just by saying, oh, it's the CIA's fault.
You wrote a column, your collateral damage column on Antiwar.com, called No Weapons of Mass Destruction? Fabulous, but still besides the point. So what is the point, then, if weapons of mass destruction isn't it?
Well, the weapons of mass destruction do have, you know, whether or not they're found, does have enormous practical political significance, as we're seeing. If they can't turn up anything in Iraq, then this is going to be a real headache for them, at least for a while, until the primaries start up next year and the public's attention moves on. But it's very important. The WMDs were very important in their framing of a justification. And so if they were outright lying about it, of course, that's critical information to know, and that should lead to serious consequences, both for Blair and for Bush. But whether or not Iraq had WMDs is irrelevant when you start to ask what would have justified a war against Iraq. The fact that they have WMDs is simply not going to cut it. Lots of countries have weapons of mass destruction. And in fact, the term is sort of nebulous anyway. You can call anything you want to weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I thought it meant particularly chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, right?
Right, but what constitutes chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons? Right now we're finding out that it doesn't even matter if you actually have those. What the British are doing right now is saying, if you can find documents that say that anyone even thought about having those, then you have a weapons of mass destruction program.
Oh, a program.
Right.
That's funny how you can just throw one more word in there and qualify everything that you said for the past year and a half.
Right.
To justify war.
But in that article, my real point was, if they had weapons of mass destruction, that still doesn't make them a threat to the U.S., still didn't make them a threat to Great Britain, didn't make them a threat to anyone except possibly Israel. And Israel has a massive army that they have gotten right off the boat from the United States, already assembled. And so are we going to war for Israel's interest, or should we let Israel take care of themselves? I mean, I assume that's what that $3 billion a year that we send them is for.
Did you read Raimondo's column the other day where he wrote about that perhaps the forged documents about the uranium from Niger actually might have come from Ariel Sharon's office?
Right. Well, it does seem that if you're just looking for who would have had a reason to put that out there, it would be, Israel would definitely have the greatest interest in doing that. I'm not sure that, I don't recall if he had any sort of substantiation for that, but at any rate, yeah, it's certainly a plausible possibility.
Is it your position that Israel is really what this war was about, and not weapons of mass destruction at all?
Israel is one thing. A lot of it just has to do, particularly for our president, with this certain sort of complex that he has that's really shown itself since the war came to its combat conclusion, or what he called its combat conclusion.
When he announced that on May Day, you mean?
Right. In that he's had this sort of confusion since then. You know, the president is not an introspective man. He's not a reflective man. And actually, among his hardcore supporters, that's considered a strength. I think that they think of reflective people as being like Woody Allen. So he's like the anti-Woody Allen. But but so he doesn't really criticize himself much. He doesn't think too much about what he does. He just does it, and that's considered decisiveness. But even so, he seems to have this personality conflict that's emerged in the last couple of weeks about whether he's going to be Jesus or Dirty Harry. And the Dirty Harry part is when he says, really taunts these guerrillas and militants in Iraq by saying, bring them on. Bring on these attacks. You know,
yeah, we have plenty more soldiers where that came from.
Right, right. Which, you know, if you had a child or a sibling or a spouse over there, I don't see how you could not be infuriated by that. But and then also in Liberia, he says about Charles Taylor, he says he won't take no for an answer. Charles Taylor has to resign. You know, bring him on, won't take no for an answer. This is a guy who is living in a movie. And unfortunately, it has consequences for other people. But now, on his Africa tour, we see the Jesus part. And if you know anything about, like, the president seems to be an adherent to this whole notion of masculine Christianity, which, if you know anything about it, it seems to want to fuse Jesus and Dirty Harry. That, you know, like, de-sissify Jesus, that you can be compassionate, but that means being tough. And that sometimes means that you have to kill people at the most extreme end.
That sounds like a pretty Christ-like doctrine.
Right. And so he's going around touring Africa and just pledging billions and billions in U.S. aid and seems to be hinting at U.S. peacekeepers, which, of course, means the U.S. troops, and I guess they just wear like a different little band around their helmet that says peacekeeper or something.
yeah, you know, they just announced actually yesterday that they're going to send 10,000 peacekeepers to the Congo as well.
Yeah, and the guy, you know, he seems to have no idea what his limits are or what the limits of the U.S. Military are. That you could put 10,000 troops just in any country you please, and never ending, and somehow you're not going to become overstretched. You're not going to just stir up troubles that you really have no business interfering in anyway. But really, over the last couple of weeks, the man has shown himself in a way that unfortunately his supporters really think is cool. You know, with all the bring them on and won't take no for an answer stuff. But this is just headed for a disaster.
I read an article, actually, I think it was on Counterpunch this morning, about how the British Empire lasted because the British people were willing to live for generations in the countries they were occupying, and that it's just kind of part of their character, that if their leaders want an empire, well, fine, they'll enforce it for them, but here our soldiers have been in Iraq a couple of months and are all ready to come home right now. They're not ready to raise their kids there and be an occupying army forever in the Middle East.
Right. And there's actually an interesting blog by a U.S. soldier that I just saw yesterday for the first time. I think it's Turning Tables, and it's a U.S. sergeant in Iraq, and he makes it clear that he's explicitly forbidden to directly criticize U.S. government policies, right? I mean, he can't question President Bush or anything like that while he's on active duty. But it gives you a real glimpse of how much the soldiers who are there hate this. And he is unsparing in his criticisms of procedural things and how difficult it is to do this sort of nation-building thing that, of course, Bush promised us he wasn't going to be doing once he got to the White House anyway. But I would definitely recommend people check that out.
That's turning. You said turningtables.com?
I believe it's turningtables.blogspot.com.
Okay. Yeah, and, you know, I keep reading articles about how our soldiers over there don't have socks, they don't have boots that last more than a week, they don't have basic radios to be able to communicate with their buddies down the street. That, I mean, it's like a 19th century occupation over there, only with M16s.
Right, and that sort of stuff seems banal, but it's precisely what makes these things impossible. And it's the sort of thing that these guys at the Weekly Standard and National Review and in the White House, who were so belligerent, so bellicose, and yet have no practical experience with such things, it's the sort of thing that they won't pay attention to. It's the sort of thing that they just ignore and think that it's trivial to even bring it up. But these are the sorts of problems that make such an occupation, especially a long-term occupation, impossible.
Yeah,
I mean,
and hey, these are our friends and neighbors over there in the hot desert sun without socks or boots that work.
Right. And it starts to cause, I'm just amazed that it's not causing more domestic problems here yet. I've gotten a sense from the British press that there are more complaints and louder complaints about the problems of British soldiers there. But here, I'm just surprised that there's not more grumbling. Or maybe there is, and it's just not being picked up on by the nightly news. But, yeah, it starts to cause domestic problems if it goes on too long. But even if it doesn't, even if we never hear about those domestic problems, it's causing problems over there right now. The Iraqi people quite obviously resent this presence of these aliens who come in and take up all their arms, or try to, can't restore the basic services that make life bearable, especially in the desert. And so as they lose sympathy for the soldiers lose whatever sympathy they might have had for the civilians they're occupying, and you're only going to see this sort of guerrilla activity worsen. You're going to see certain segments of the population there, which probably might have even greeted the U.S. soldiers as liberators. You're going to see them become radicalized. And it's going to be, I don't want to draw too much of overdraw as a historical analogy, but it will be the way that Ho Chi Minh and company looked at the U.S. You know, in World War II, they looked at the U.S. As a benign, helping influence. But they were radicalized when the U.S. decided that it wasn't going to just leave them be, and that, in fact, it was going to intervene to reestablish something that they had tried the whole war to get rid of with U.S. support. And, you know, it's amazing that after all this time, I guess all of these puppets like Halabi have just fallen to the wayside. They have just proven completely inept, or else the Iraqi people have demonstrated that they don't want them there. It's just amazing that after this long, the U.S. government still has nothing to fill the void that it's created.
Did they even have a plan for the occupation and how it was going to be? And if they didn't have a plan, why not?
I haven't read anything that indicated that they did, and we're starting to see more things lately that flat out say they had no such plan, which is quite typical of, again, these sorts of people who have no practical experience at such things, no practical experience at anything, really. If you look at George W. Bush, at business or at military things or anything that might help right now in reconstructing Iraq or creating a peaceful situation there so that the troops can leave, it's just go do it, shoot first, and then expect roads and 747s, you know, at the Iraqi airport, at the Baghdad airport. We have all these reports of U.S. troops not just stealing candy and cigarettes and magazines and stuff, but actually going out just for fun, ripping up the airplanes and shooting them, and that somehow you can do that, and then magically, once you've won the war, all of those things will be repaired, and it's just a matter of finding a friendly regime to come in, which all the people, of course, will love, and then you just, you know, you go and you set up, I assume that part of the plan, at least for the really big thinkers in the administration like Wolfowitz and Pearl, is to have a permanent military presence in Iraq. Not as outright occupiers, I don't think, but as, you know, in the same way that we have bases in Italy and Germany and Japan.
So I was going to ask you if they believe their own BS, but perhaps maybe you're saying that Wolfowitz and Pearl and people like that, they really prefer it this way, that they really would rather have American bases in that area for years to come.
Yeah, I think that it seems to be a perfect strategic location, that from there you could monitor both what goes on to the east in Iran, and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and so forth. But also, back to the West, you could protect Israel. So, you know, these are guys who take the long view. Not necessarily the correct long view, not a logical long view, not one that's really informed by a serious consideration of economics and culture and so forth, but a long view that says, if you just ignore all of these little problems in the meantime, then our wonderful grand plan for the Middle East and really for the world will eventually come to fruition. And then everyone will be happy.
Well, and for the record, they lied to our troops and told them we're going to go in there and get Saddam and get out and you'll be home by the middle of summer, right?
Oh, of course. I mean, they've been lying to everyone. They've lied to the troops. They've lied to the American people. They've lied to the Iraqis. They've lied to each other. I mean, that's one of the funniest things about these scandals, about these the dossier in Great Britain, and in Bush's speech. Now we're starting to get into this Clintonian word parsing, where one of the original defenses, and I only saw this in one article, but it's so telling. The defense of that statement about the uranium going to Iraq was that they didn't say that they knew that uranium had gone to Iraq from Niger, but that the British knew it, or that the British had a report, right? I mean, this is...
I heard NPR repeating that line yesterday on the afternoon news.
Yeah. That just says so much. That's the sort of little detail that really probably won't get played up that much. But it seems that they were consciously providing plausible deniability later, you know?
When you mentioned the dossier, you're talking about the graduate student's report that was posing as an MI6 study?
Right. Well, not just that, but they had just catched things from all sorts of sources and acted as if... you know, from old U.S. military reports and so forth, and acted as if it was something they had seen with their own eyes, that they had their own intelligence information on. So, yeah, they've been lying to each other.
It's almost hilarious if it wasn't so tragic.
Right.
I wonder, hey, if we tried, do you think we could go through and, you know, off the top of our heads, see if we can list all the lies that they told, say, in the last year as the run-up for this war?
I don't think that we have enough time. And also, I think that what the president's defenders constantly say, if you, I spend an enormous amount of time looking at the organs of Bush propaganda, the main ones being, of course, Fox News. On the website, I just cannot stand to watch and listen to it. But so I check out their website daily, and Weekly Standard, and National Review, and Free Republic, and so forth. And they have just been churning out one explanation after another, one legalistic excuse for this or that fib. It is just, these are the people who were so critical of Bill Clinton, and rightly so, over things that, in retrospect, seem very minor. You know, most of the things. Of course, these were the same people who supported Clinton's wars on Yugoslavia and bombings in Sudan and Afghanistan.
Right, I was going to say, they supported all the worst things he did.
Right,
they only
right.
attacked him for the minor stuff.
Right. And of course, they were basically complicit in things like Waco. They certainly, you know, they knew that appealed to their base, so they played it up a little bit. But
yeah, they put Arlen Specter, the originator of the magic bullet theory, in charge of the hearings in the Senate.
Oh, right. I mean, they totally, you know, that one was doomed by design, the investigation into Waco and into other Clinton abuses of police power. But they were so good at going through all of these little minute statements that Clinton had made and talking about how, you know, how it wasn't true, or even if it was true, how it wasn't the whole truth. And now they have just turned into this nonstop Johnny Cochran for the administration.
It's sort of like there's so many reasons for the war that you can't pin one down, and there's so many excuses for why all the reasons for the war were lies that you can't really pin any of them down to into one paragraph. So it's just sort of this giant nebulous list of reasons and lies backing up those reasons that can't really be summed up in an effective way, I guess.
Oh, yeah, and it's interesting to me that one of the things that they've seized on lately is the looting story. This is their sort of counter-aha. If you recall, right after the war came to its official conclusion, there were reports of all this looting of antiquities in Iraq. And I even wrote an essay on that myself. Some of the reports that came out just in the first couple of days had really ludicrously high figures for things missing. And I don't think that anyone who was writing editorials, at least not any of the editorials that I read, used those figures. Like this guy at the museum in Baghdad said, I think that there were 170,000 missing pieces from there. Well, when I read that, I was a bit skeptical. Even if there were 170,000 missing pieces, it didn't mean that they were lost forever. And so I didn't include that figure. And neither did any of the anti-war or Bush skeptical commentators that I read. They just remarked that, you know, a lot of pieces were missing and clearly destroyed because there was footage of destroyed pieces. Now, this has become the warmongers' big aha, that they can look back and say, oh, look at that, 170,000 that all these people were talking about, and now it just turns out that it's like 35. Well, in reality, that's just at the Baghdad Museum, of course, and it's more than that. That's not counting, like, Tikrit and all of these archaeological sites. But it is funny that this is their real, this is their version of catching their enemies in a lie. And they really haven't.
It just shows how deep they're trying to grasp. I mean, when everything that they said leading up to it was a lie. I mean, they show these pictures over and over again of the Saddam Hussein statue falling down, and it turns out that it was our troops pulling it down, and there wasn't a single citizen of Baghdad anywhere in sight. It was only foreigners that we had just imported.
Right. And, yeah, it's... they try at all costs, and understandably so, to cover up what they have said before, and to find ex post facto justifications that were that had nothing to do with what they originally claimed were reasons for invading Iraq. And I don't know, it's just very typical of their approach to things.
Now, when you say there, who exactly were we talking about? Beyond just the administration or beyond that?
Actually, I was kind of continuing on the line of thought about the right-wing journalist at National Review and Weekly Standard primarily, and Fox
right,
News.
Right. And actually, that makes me wonder about the neoliberals, because there were a lot of people besides, you know, this set of neocons that really antiwar.com describes better than anybody else. Besides them, there's pretty much the entire foreign policy establishment of this country was behind this war, weren't they?
The New Republic would be a great example of that. And I have to check up on them, unfortunately, so that my readers don't have to. They're dull as dirt. At least in National Review, you can get an occasional interesting or humorous piece, but the New Republic almost seems as if it's made to be esoteric, so that no one will read it. But they, you know, they came out with a good piece a couple of weeks ago, which really laid out all of the lies and all of the willful manipulations that the administration made in the build-up to war. Just a great piece. And then the editors come right out a couple of days later and put this disclaimer that, you know, if all of that's true, you can get rid of Bush, but the war was still a great thing because of what it accomplished from a humanitarian perspective, and of course, in terms of spreading the great God of democracy throughout the world. So
yeah, everybody in Iraq is so much better off than they were before, obviously.
Right. It's amazing, really, when you get to foreign policy, these people who are supposed to be at each other's throats, like the New Republic and National Review, you know, the liberals versus the conservatives, there's so much unanimity. You would really have a difficult time discovering any difference on foreign policy.
Oh, well, one wants to take over the world by way of the United Nations, and the other wants to take over the world by way of NATO.
Right. The differences do seem to be procedural or technical. There's certainly no fundamental philosophical difference.
Mr. Barganier, I have a problem here. I was reading antiwar.com yesterday, and I found this very interesting headline, and I clicked on it, and it turns out that I agree with Gary Bauer. Gary Bauer apparently had a meeting with the government over there in Israel, and he came out and he said that the United States has no business telling the Israeli government what to do in terms of their policy in dealing with the Palestinians. And while I'm nowhere near Gary Bauer on really anything else, or even what I would like to see the Israeli government do with their newfound freedom from our control of their policy, I can't help but agree with him that we really shouldn't be telling Israel or the Palestinians what to do.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with him, too. Except that this becomes one of those, well, what's the whole statement issues? What did he really mean by that?
Well, he really meant was he wants Israel to be able to kill anybody they want and never
right.
be criticized.
Right. He wants U.S. money to keep going to Israel. And I'm sure that he would prefer it in much larger stacks of bills. But just don't tell them what to do. You know, it's that they are God's chosen people. And so it's up to the U.S. taxpayers to make that a reality, to make their chosenness manifest. But don't tell them what to do. So, yeah, I love these guys. These guys can turn on a dime, can't they? They can be non-interventionist when it suits the purposes of Israel. But again, when you look at the whole story, they still want intervention. They just want it with no strings attached.
Hey everybody, we're listening to an interview with Matt Barganier. He writes Collateral Damage on antiwar.com. He wrote a column, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago called We're All Israelis Now, Except for the Palestinians. So,
yes, I did.
Is that all of us?
Well, if you listen to certain people in this country, you would think so. I mean, that phrase has become quite common. When I go through and write my pieces, I try to link as much stuff as I can so that people know that I'm not just, they know what's mine and they know what I've culled from other sources. And if you Google that phrase, you get quite a few returns on it. The We're All Israelis Now thing started after September 11th, the notion being that the Israelis are so used to facing terrorist attacks, and now we have some idea of what that's like. Granted, it was like years and years of terrorist attacks all rolled up into one and delivered at once. But still, the somehow this imbued us with some sort of kinship to the Israelis, or rather made us understand the kinship that was always there. It's an interesting notion, how anyone from one country, perhaps this is just semantics, but it has some significance when you start talking about national sovereignty, how anyone from one country can be from another country. No one would ever say we're all Canadians now. It's understood that even though the U.S. and Canada are right next door to each other and, in fact, quite alike, and it's difficult to distinguish a Canadian from an American, that the U.S. and Canada do, in fact, have separate interests.
Sure, and I think the average Canadian is probably scared that the catchphrase around there is becoming, we're all Americans now.
Right. But somehow this country, half a world away, which is quite different from our own, which doesn't make it bad or anything, but it is different. It's a theocracy, even though by local standards it's fairly liberal. It's a country that is, although not totally segregationist or racially exclusive, it is in great part that, and somehow, and of course it's much more socialist than the United States is, but somehow we're supposed to believe that our lives and interests and concerns and our political aims, insofar as there are any collective political aims that are legitimate, are exactly identical with theirs. And it's just, it doesn't really withstand much scrutiny.
A Republican voter said to me just the other day that, hey, Saddam Hussein, he funded terrorists. And I said, well, but the Al-Qaeda base in Iraq was in the north, the area that we and the Kurds already control. He said, no, he sends money to the families of suicide bombers. And I said, but man, those are suicide bombers in Israel, which isn't a state in the Union, and that we have no obligation to protect. Hamas and Hezbollah don't blow up themselves in subways or in pizza parlors or movie theaters in America. They never have.
Right. And of course, if one wants to sympathize with Israel, that's perfectly fine. If you want to send your own money over there, write an editorial, whatever. But it's just ridiculous to act as if U.S. taxpayers and U.S. soldiers have some, and ultimately U.S. civilians, because they're the ones who catch the brunt of all this blowback, from the U.S. support of Israel, as if all of these people have some sort of duty to this foreign country. You know, I mean, Ann Coulter wants to go around screaming treason, and David Horowitz wants to go around screaming treason all the time. Somebody should be screaming treason about this, the U.S. Policy towards Israel.
You know, I think it was in your column, your link on the words, "We're all Israelis now," was to an editorial on the page of the Ayn Rand Institute. And the guy wrote about, I noticed, I think it was in the first or second paragraph there, about that 3,000 New Yorkers dying is like 45,000 per capita dying in Israel or something like that. And I just thought, like, what a collectivist concept to be reading on the web pages of the Ayn Rand Institute that somehow individual human lives are to be ratioed per capita to the size of the country where their deaths occurred.
Right, right. I have heard that before. For a long time, certain Israel sympathizers, every time that there was a bombing in Israel, they did the per capita equivalence, that, you know, there's something like 5 million Israelis and 300 million people in the U.S. And so thus, you know, if four people died in a bombing in Israel, it was the same thing as 240 people dying in a bombing in the United States. It is a bizarre mentality. I have not been able to wrap my mind around that.
Well, it's strictly a matter of, once you've embraced collectivism and individual human lives aren't counted one by one anymore, then you can be made to believe any silly old thing, I guess.
Yeah, and... We're getting a great deal of silliness on Israel, especially now when the U.S. seems poised to be even more tightly connected to, the U.S. government seems to be even more tightly connected to Israel than it's ever been before. And of course, there's a long back history there. But the silliness I'm talking about is how suddenly nobody is an agent for Israel in this country. Even the people who clearly advocate Israel's interests above those of American citizens, they run from it. They act as if they have no power or influence, which is a very odd thing for a political group or a lobbying group to do, right?
I mean, well, sure, and they call you a bigot for pointing that out.
Right. It's very funny to see... the America-Israel Pact, AIPAC, acts as if, you know, whenever they get confronted with these charges, not really charges, but just observations that they have a lot of power and influence in Washington, they act as if they don't. Now, the AFL-CIO and the American Association of Retired Persons, they don't act as if they don't have any power or influence. You know, if you say to the AFL, if anything, the AFL-CIO and the AARP act as if they have more influence than they really do, you know. They depend on a broad base of small contributors, and so they have to convince those people that their interests, you know, rightly or wrongly construed, are really being represented in Washington. If you want to take the extreme opposite example, look at the Libertarian Party. I mean, I'm sure you get these little Libertarian Party newsletters, and I do too, in which they act as if, because someone's been elected constable in South Dakota, you know, the face of American politics has changed forever.
That it were so.
Right. But in other words, the Libertarian Party grossly exaggerates its own influence and power, whereas the Israel lobby, which really does have a lot of power and influence, does the opposite of what you would think a lobbying organization would do. They act as if they have no influence. Of course, they don't act that way when they send out the letters to their donors. And Michael Kinsley wrote a great article on that several months ago about if you look at these fundraising letters that AIPAC sends out, you know, they certainly play up how much influence and power they have when it comes down to trying to get money out of someone.
Would you go so far as to say that Bill Kristol and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle or any or all of those are literally agents of the Israeli government?
No, not literally in the sense that they actually get paid by Israel or anything like that. But I think for them it is sort of a... they wouldn't even want it to be dirtied by pay, you know? It's an ideological and moral crusade for them, the health of Israel, or what they perceive to be the health of Israel. I have written about how that tends to be different. The real health of Israel tends to be different from what U.S. government policy thinks it is. But that it's a much larger crusade for them. And so, no, I don't think that they think of themselves that way, and I'm not sure that it would be fair to call them that if by agent you mean, you know, someone who receives some direct quid pro quo for doing it. But they clearly see Israel's continued existence and prosperity as more important than that of the United States.
Do you think that, I mean, I guess we already got past the point that we shouldn't have anything to do with this in the first place, but since we do, and Bush is promoting this roadmap with the new Prime Minister of the Palestinians, Abbas, and Ariel Sharon playing the peace dove on the Israeli side, do you think that there's any hope for this roadmap, or is it made to fail like all the ones before?
I'm not sure that it's intentionally made to fail. It will fail because the terms dictated are, you know, it's impossible for the United States to play an impartial role here. You cannot send one country $3 billion a year. And, of course, the U.S. sends money, a tiny trifle, to the Palestinian Authority, which I don't want them to send it to them either. But when you send in one country $3 billion a year, and then you send this little pittance of humanitarian aid to the country that needs humanitarian aid precisely because of the country you support, any U.S. involvement there can never be perceived as fair or impartial. And I think that causes internal problems on the Palestinian side. And, of course, it causes internal problems on the Israeli side because these far-right settler types consider anything short of unlimited Israeli expansion to be a betrayal. I mean, if you look at what these Kahane followers say on their various websites, particularly Kahane.org, I mean, these guys act as if Ariel Sharon is the most weak-kneed little sellout wimp you could imagine.
Well, after all, the Bible says that Israel goes all the way to the Tigris and the Euphrates, right?
That's true, and people should keep that in mind when they understand or when they're listening to Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and Gary Bauer talk about Israel and Israel's right to exist that we hear about all the time. Keep in mind the subtext, or their subtext.
How are we going to fix all this?
Well, I'm not sure that I consider it my job to do anything positive. I tend to be more of a critic, and sometimes I try to offer some solutions, although it's usually kind of just throwing my hands up and at the absurdity of it all. But, you know, the things that could be done to fix it are going to take a long time to do. I certainly don't see anyone having a shot at winning public office anytime soon on this platform of withdrawal from the world, or withdrawal of the U.S. military from the world, and letting other nations be, and pursuing peace and prosperity right here at home. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but the only thing that's going to make the situation better and to remove us as the A1 target of terrorism is going to be pulling U.S. troops out and not interfering in all these other more subtle ways that we do in other countries' affairs.
All right, everybody. This has been an interview with Matt Barganier. He writes Collateral Damage on antiwar.com. Hey, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
No problem.